Welcome to another Biology on the Beach. This is Dr. Leo Stouter. We're here broadcasting from Dania Beach today. It's a beautiful day. We're going to be talking about nutrition. Now, when we talked before, we mentioned that there were autotrophs and that there were heterotrophs. Autotroph, as you remember, was had the ability to make its own food, and that was going to be auto, remember? And we described these as plants. So we said that plants are going to be able to make their own food. And then we had heterotrophs who were not able to make their own food. And hetero meant other. So they need to eat other things in order to live. So the autotroph makes its own food. And really the heterotroph is going to partake in the autotroph in one way or another. You know, in the plant. Like, for instance, the herbivore. An herbivore is going to be just eating plants. That's going to be his major source of energy. So he's going to go directly to the source. And that's going to be, like, for instance, a deer or a horse. And your deer's name should go there. So if you have a deer, put his name there, his or her name there. We also have a carnivore. A carnivore is going to be a meat eater. Like your dog or your cat, you put their name there. And they're going to benefit from plants because the animal that ate the plants, such as an herbivore, carnivore would eat. So they're going to benefit from plants. And also the omnivore. Omnivore is going to be the animals that can eat both. And they're able to go both ways, eating vegetables and also eating meat. And you can put your name there. Because that's what we would consider ourselves to be, omnivores. We're able to eat both vegetables and meat without any problem. Now when we do eat, we're going to be allowing for our digestion to occur. And digestion is going to be starting in the mouth, and then it's going to go to the esophagus. Our food then will go to the stomach, small intestine, large intestine, rectum, and then the anus. So if you were to eat an apple, put your apple going first in your mouth because you're chewing it, and then you're going to swallow it still in the mouth, and then it's going to get into the esophagus. The esophagus then is going to bring it down into the stomach, where the stomach will cause the first phase, one of the first phases of digestion, and then you're going to go to the small intestine. The small intestine then will extract the nutrients from that apple. And then it'll go to the large intestine that will extract some of the water and also basically prepare it as a waste product. And then you're going to get rid of that waste product of the apple, you know, the fiber that's in it or things that you really don't need to eat or that to utilize, like, for instance, the outside covering of the apple, maybe if you ate a seed or something like that. That's all going to be considered waste products unless the body broke it down. Then it's going to go into your rectum where it's sort of held there until you decide to get rid of it through your anus. So it's basically the way it works, graphically speaking. When we look at the upper GI tract or gastrointestinal tract, we see that we have our mouth first. And this is where digestion first occurs. What we do is we mechanically break down the food. So we have a large piece of apple, let's say. And we will then use our teeth to break that apple down into smaller pieces. What that does is it increases the surface area of those individual pieces. If you picture an apple, let's say an apple's, let's say you have a piece of an apple that's about an inch long. So you eat that apple, and if you picture the apple would be, let's say, an inch around. So you'd say it's an inch square. So the surface area would be just what the outside would be. So that would be, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, be about 6 inches of surface area if you picture it being a cube. Now that being the case then, that's 6 inches of surface area. Wouldn't it be nice to have more surface area so that we could actually use our enzymes to break it down better? So how are we going to do that? Well, if we were to take that cube and divide it into half, now you've increased your surface area. divide it in even more, you increase your surface area and even more. So the point is that the smaller you break down something, the more you have surface area. And the more surface area you have, the easier it is going to be for the enzymes to actually do their job. One of the major enzymes in our mouth is going to be amylase. And amylase, as you remember, A's means it's going to be an enzyme. Amyl is going to be like starch. So it's going to be a starch acting enzyme. So it's going to assist in the biological process of breaking down starch. So that's going to be starting in our mouth. So it's a good idea for us to chew starchy foods so we can start the digestion of those starches like pastas or any kind of fruits or any, most vegetables, you know, have some starch components in them, because that's what we talked about as being the storage that the plant will actually store their food as starch. So it's a good idea to use your mouth and to chew your foods properly. That can be the first problem with a lot of people's digestive problems. It can be because they are not able to actually chew their foods properly. Maybe they have the dental problems, or they just don't do it. You know, they're in a hurry or whatever else, and that can be the start of some digestive disorders only because the food has not gotten a chance to actually digest itself. Now the onus is put on the stomach to do the job that the mouth should be doing. So the mouth and the stomach, of course, work together, but the stomach has no teeth. So it can't break things down as effectively as your teeth can. So once we have something in our mouth, and then when we swallow, right away what's going to happen is that our esophagus, which is the tube connecting our mouth to our stomach, is going to start working. And there's going to be a process called peristalsis. Peristalsis is just a fancy word for a squeezing of that tube. So there's muscles inside of our esophagus that are going to squeeze behind our food, and it's going to push that food into our stomach. These peristaltic waves are not dependent upon gravity because they're muscles. So you could essentially eat something and then turn yourself upside down, and that food that you swallow will ultimately go into your stomach. Now, because you're upside down, it may come back out if you vomit or whatever else, but it's going to your stomach first. So if you have yourself upside down, it's still going to go into your stomach because of the peristaltic action of the esophagus. So once you swallow something, it's going to be in your stomach within a matter of seconds. Now, once the food does get to the stomach, the stomach will churn. It has a variety of muscles inside of it, and these muscles are going to contract and actually churn the substance that you put in there. So you're going to be having this churning going on. And this is also where protein digestion is going to be starting. So we have a digestive function here. Now the thing is that because of the fact that the stomach is not really an absorber, it's going to be really a digester. It's not going to really have anything that's going to go into the bloodstream from the stomach, except for two components. The stomach allows absorption of aspirin and also of alcohol. So aspirin is going to be absorbed through the stomach lining. So is alcohol going to be absorbed through the stomach lining into the blood system. All other components are not going to be absorbed here. Most of the absorption is going to be occurring in our small intestine. And we'll talk about that in a moment. When we think about us as far as our teeth are concerned, we can think that our teeth are going to be composed of grinders. They're also going to be composed of some tearers. If we look at herbivorous teeth, or the herbivores, we see that their dentition is going to be mostly flat and grinding kind of teeth on the top and bottom. So they're going to be taking in their plant substances, and they're going to be grinding them one on top of another with a nice broad surface. And those are considered molars, so those are going to be the molars. But they have a lot of molars because they need to really grind the plant so they can get the nutrients inside the cell. Remember that the plant has a outside covering called the cellulose or the cell wall. and that is going to be around the inside, which of course is the regular cell. So to get the nutrients, you got to get inside the cell. So that's exactly the reason for that dentition. Now, if we look at carnivorous teeth or the carnivores, we see that they're jagged. They're not flat. They're jagged, and that means that they're more interested in tearing, and they are. They're more interested in tearing the flesh because they're just into eating meat. Now, we think of us, we think of our back teeth as being sort of like the herbivorous animals because they have these broad, flat teeth, and so do we. We have molars in the back of our jaw, and in front, we have some teeth that are not broad, but are sort of a little bit more for tearing. Those would be the incisors in front and the canines that are in front. So when we look net-net, how many teeth we have for grinding, how many teeth we have for tearing, and how many teeth we just have for regular chewing, we might see that the human has a variety, don't they? They don't have the carnivorous. They don't have the herbivorous, they have a combination. That's why we consider us to be omnivores. We're able to eat both meat and vegetables just by looking at our teeth. In addition, we see that we have more teeth that are going to be flat, and that implies then our diet should be more vegetables and fruits rather than lots of meats. If we just were supposed to just eat meat, our teeth would be all tearers, like we see with the carnivorous teeth. But our teeth do not just tear. They also are going to be chewing as well. We only have a few teeth that really would be considered to be tearing, the incisors and the canines, but the rest of the teeth are really going to be for chewing. So looking at that, then, we can see that we are well-equipped to be a omnivore. Now, when we look at our large intestine, that's going to be after our small intestine, we just talked about. We look at our small intestine after the stomach. We see that the small intestine is going to be all about absorption. It wants to absorb our foods. And absorption is going to be the next half of digestion. First we digest, or we break down our foods, and then we absorb those foods through the intestinal wall into our blood system. So the small intestine is going to have finger-like projections called villi. These villi increase the surface area of the small intestine. So if we picture, for instance, a piece of small intestine, and let's just picture a 3-inch portion of it, and it's just flat. So picture a ruler with just 3 inches, okay, and it's flat. So that would mean that within that 0 to 3 inches, you're going to be having 3 inches of surface area on that ruler. Now, if we were to take that ruler and then cause it to enfold on itself, then we would increase the surface area. So now let's do this. Picture that you have a piece of carpet, and the carpet has a nice pile on it. It's nice and soft, and it sticks up a bit. Okay. Now let's make that a 3-inch piece of carpet. Now, that being the case, then, this carpet is going to have 3 inches of surface area. But if you picture each of those pieces of piling as being a piece of surface area, then you'll say, oh, there's a lot more surface area there because each of those pieces of cloth that's sticking up from the carpet is increasing the surface area, and that's what villi are. Villi are like those pieces of the carpet sticking up. So they help to increase the surface area. So therefore, they're going to be more into being absorptive. They're going to be able to absorb the nutrients because you have more surface area. So the small intestine is longer than we are tall. It's very long. And there's also going to be some digestion occurring in the small intestine as well through the same process as we talked about before with how things get from the mouth to the stomach through peristalsis. Peristalsis is going to push things through the intestine, through the muscular action, and absorption is going to be occurring as well. So the large intestine is going to be where we're going to be putting our substances after they have been absorbed So we've taken out the nutrients from them, and now we're going to be putting them into the large intestine. If the colon doesn't do its job, that's also the other term for the large intestine is the colon. They're synonymous terms. If the colon doesn't do its job, then a watery stool could result, because one of the major functions of the colon is to extract the water from what we have eaten. So when we look at our diagram of the GI tract, we see that we have an upper tube. And what's that upper tube called? Good, the esophagus. Then you have a lower that's attached to the esophagus, and that's going to be your first organ of digestion, and that's going to be your stomach, exactly. And then we're going to be looking at the small intestine and the large intestine. Now, we already talked about us and our teeth, and it looks like that we should be omnivores. But also, let's consider the length of the gastrointestinal tract. Carnivores have a very short gastrointestinal tract. Why? Because they eat meat. Meat can be able to be putrefied, or it can become rancid. It can become, degenerated, torn down. It can become like that very easily. If you take a steak and put it out into the sunshine, eventually you'll see it start to, become gray and looking pretty ugly. That's because meat really doesn't have that great of a shelf life, as you know. All meat's got to be frozen or at least refrigerated. So that being the case then, we don't want that in a nice warm environment such as the body, like the body of a cat. So you want the meat to go in and the meat to go out pretty fast, so there's no putrefaction. And that's the reason that we have a short gastrointestinal tract in carnivores. The herbivore, however, has a very long intestinal tract. All they're doing is eating plants. Plants aren't going to be putrefying, and therefore, they have a very long gastrointestinal tract, over 200 feet in some animals. That's pretty long, 200 feet. Now, the length of our intestinal tract is somewhere in the middle. It's not really, really short, not as long as an herbivore either. So that tells us that we should be eating more vegetables, less meat, because if we had a real short intestinal tract, it would say eat more meat. But if we had a real, real long one, it would say eat all vegetables. So since we're somewhere in the middle, we see that we need to really have a diet that has both of the vegetables and meat, but more vegetables. Once again, our teeth told us that, and now our intestines are telling us that as well. Now, when we looked at digestion and absorption, I sort of talked about it before, but for now, let's just put a little finer understanding. The digestion happens inside the GI or gastrointestinal tract. Food is broken down, and the major organ for this is going to be the stomach. Now, absorption is going to happen outside the GI tract, in other words, through the gastrointestinal wall. This is absorption of nutrients through the intestinal wall, and they go right into the blood. Major organ for absorption is going to be the small intestine. Now remember that the stomach also shares a little bit of absorption. We said it can absorb two substances. Remember what that was? Good. Aspirin and also alcohol. And we also mentioned that the small intestine can do some digestion. We said it's going to use peristalsis to move the food through. It's also going to be, there's going to be some digestion occurring in the small intestine as well. So they share digestion and absorption, but the major organ for digestion would be considered the stomach, and the major organ for absorption would be considered the small intestine. Now, accessory organs to the gastrointestinal tract. We already talked about the gastrointestinal tract from the mouth to the anus. Now these are accessories. These are going to be actually acting upon the gastrointestinal tract and assisting in absorption and also in digestion, more digestion and absorption. So all the blood from your intestines that gets absorbed from your small intestine and also from the large is going to go through your liver before it goes to your body. This is so that your body can, your liver can scrutinize whatever is coming in. So they can do a variety of things. They can store. Things go there first, so it can store glycogen, for instance, which is our energy source. It can also store minerals. We know that if we eat liver, that we have a lot of iron in liver, and that's because the liver stores iron. And there's thousands of metabolic processes that occur here. There's metabolism of carbohydrates, proteins, and also fats. There's detoxification that occurs. And detoxification would be where you take something that's toxic and you make it non-toxic, or at least less toxic. An example of this would be, for instance, if, let's say, a person drinks some bleach. Bleach, as we know, is mostly chlorine. That's why we call it chlorine bleach. So that would be Cl, and that would be very, very toxic for a person. Once it goes to the liver in the individual, the liver could detoxify it. If they haven't drank that much, it won't kill them because the liver will detoxify it. And how will the liver detoxify it? Well, one of the ways is through conjugation. The process of conjugation means that you're going to be adding something to that toxic substance. So in this case, the liver could add a sodium molecule to sodium element to the chlorine element. Put the sodium and chlorine together, and of course you get sodium chloride, and that would be your common table salt. And common table salt, is, as you know, is not toxic. So that would be a way for the liver to detoxify something that was very, very bad, and to really render it safe or safer, so that the body then could get rid of it as salt, rather than have to deal with the toxic effects of the chlorine. And that was through the process of conjugation. There's other ways that the liver does this process as well. So that's detoxification. And metabolism, as you remember, was a breaking down or a building up of foods. So in metabolism, that's where the bulk of metabolism occurs, is going to be in our liver. Now our gallbladder is going to be located just underneath the liver. It's a greenish organ. It's green because it contains bile. And bile is a product that's produced by the liver. And the bile is going to be assisting in digestion of fats. The process is called emulsification. Emulsification means a breaking down of fat. For the same reason, if we have a big fat molecule, let's say it's about an inch around, the surface area of that fat molecule is going to be pretty low. If we break that fat molecule down into small little fat globules, surface area is going to be increased and we're going to be able to digest it better. So therefore, emulsification of fat is very important for us to absorb our fats. And bile is going to assist in that, because bile is going to be deposited in the small intestine, in the first part of the small intestine, called the duodenum. And it's going to allow for fat digestion. Then there's also going to be the pancreas. It's going to send in its enzymes, too, in the same area in the duodenum. And the pancreas is going to help with its enzymes that are going to really benefit our digestion. We have protease, for instance, from the pancreas, which is going to help with protein digestion. We have lipase, which will help with fat digestion. We also have a number of other enzymes that the pancreas makes to assist in digestion. Pancreas also produces two hormones, and these hormone-like substances are going to be affecting the cells. One of them is called glucagon, and glucagon is going to have the effect of raising blood sugar, whereas insulin, the other hormone, is going to have the effect of lowering blood sugar, but allowing the cell to get its energy source from the sugar, from the glucose. And we'll talk more about the glucagon and insulin in just a few. In fact, we'll talk about that right now. In blood sugar regulation, we have to picture what's going on in the blood. So picture the blood flow. So we're picturing a vessel, a blood vessel, and inside the blood vessel is blood. And inside the blood is going to be, it's going to be carrying sugar. And sugar, as you remember, is the source of our energy. That's the way we make our ATP. So when your blood sugar, or we'll say blood glucose as well, goes down, so now you have a decreased blood glucose, the pancreas produces a substance called glucagon. Glucagon will be causing the release of glucose from your liver to go into your blood. Remember we said that the liver is going to store glycogen. So glycogen is going to be in the liver, and that's going to be an energy source. That glycogen then is going to be acted upon by glucagon, which then will allow for your blood sugar to start to raise. The result is that your blood sugar raises to a normal level. Remember, glucagon makes sugar gone from the liver, so it affects the liver directly. Now let's say that you just had a meal, and in that meal you had lots and lots of sugar. Let's say you had a few donuts and some coffee with lots and lots of sugar in it. So you have lots of sugar in your blood now. So that means that you have too much sugar. So the blood sugar is too high. How is your body going to deal with that? Well, it's going to use insulin. Insulin will allow for your cells to take up that sugar. So insulin is like a go-between. So insulin will allow for the blood sugar to actually go into the cells, which are, as you know, outside of the blood system. So they're going to be going into, your muscle cells, into your kidney cells, into your bone cells, into all your cells. All your cells in your brain cells, your nerve cells, all cells that need, of course, energy so they can do their job. So it's going to allow for, insulin's going to allow for the sugar to go into these cells. And the result then will be that your blood sugar will be lowered to a normal level. So remember that insulin makes sugar go in to the cells. That's its primary purpose. So we see then, if we look at insulin and glucagon, we can see that they're antagonistic. They have opposite effects. If your blood sugar goes too low, you're going to need who? Glucagon, very good. If your blood sugar goes too high, you're going to need who? Insulin, right? And together, they allow for you to have a stable blood sugar. Another thing that can assist in blood sugar levels is going to be exercise. Exercise is going to be very important for us because it's going to allow for an increase of circulation through all our organs. It makes our organs just work better. So when we look at the process that we just talked about, let's say that we have too much sugar and insulin will not be able to lower it too much. Let's say it's already been stored in the liver, and let's say our liver has enough glycogen, so we've already stored enough there, but we still have more of the, and our cells have taken in all the glucose they can stand, or that they need. So now we have a lot more of the sugar around. What are we going to do with all this sugar? Well, we're going to have to store it. And the liver will convert the excess glucose to fat. That's how we get fat. We have excess glucose because we've eaten more than we really need. And therefore, then, it becomes fat, or it becomes a storage source. And you go, well, why would we do this? Why would we eat too much? Well, some of it is hereditary. Some of it is our genes saying that we need to have a storage around. Some of it is genetic. It's just that we store it in certain areas. Some of it is just emotional. Some of it is that we're not getting enough exercise. Because if we take in enough carbohydrates or glucose, and if we burn it off, then we should be at a stable weight. So as we tend to get older, we tend to have a decrease of metabolism. It's estimated that about every 10 years, we decrease our metabolism by about 5%. So by the time we're 50 years old, you figure now we've probably decreased our metabolism by 50% of when we were just a kid, or at least 40%. So, let's see, is that right? 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, no, 25%. So we're, as we age, we decrease our metabolism as well. So exercise becomes even more important for our metabolism. Why does exercise work? Well, exercise is going to actually be burning off that excess of glucose that we have eaten. Will it take care of the fat? Well, sometimes not, depending on how much we exercise. Now, why does aerobic exercise help with weight loss and not anaerobic? Anaerobic is exercise where we do not use air properly. So we're not going to be have a huge energy usage. But aerobic exercise uses a lot more energy. So aerobic exercise will be more important for weight loss. And what is aerobic? Well, we're going to be using air. And a classic way of knowing if you're exercising aerobically is if you can talk and say a few words. If you're totally out of breath, then you're operating anaerobically. So how do you know if you're in the aerobic zone? Well, the best way is if you can talk, of course, but also to really figure out what your beats per minute of your heart are. There's a zone that each of us have, and you can calculate it by taking your age, or taking 180 minus your age. This will equal the high pulse rate. You minus that by 10, and that gives you your low pulse rate. This zone between the two numbers is called the zone, the exercise zone. And this is your aerobic zone. So let's say that you're 40 years old. So you take 180 minus your age, 40. So that would mean 140 would be your top number. So you'd want to have your pulse be at least 140 beats per minute. Then you subtract 10 from that, so that would be 130. So if you're 40 years old, you should be operating in the zone of 130 beats per minute to 140 beats per minute. So you got those 10 beats per minute in between, which is called your aerobic zone. So if you're able to maintain that, and you should maintain it for at least 20 minutes, 3 to 4 times a week, then you'll be exercising in your aerobic zone, and you'll get a cardiovascular benefit. It's going to help your heart. But also, it could assist in also a weight loss benefit as well. So that's what's recommended, is at least 3 to 4 times a week of getting in the zone for at least 20 minutes. Now, that doesn't mean that you're exercising only for 20 minutes, because it's going to take you time to get into the aerobic zone. And then that would be called a warm-up. And then you'd also have time on the other end where you'd have to actually have a cool down. So your 20 minutes of in the zone might be really 30 or 40 minutes, depending on your warm-up and your cool down. So that's what's really recommended. And when we look at exercise, and let's just talk about it practically, we think of, let's say we decide to go out on our bike. And we're going to go out on our bike and exercise for an hour. So we have a heart monitor, which is one of the best ways of knowing if you're in the aerobic zone. They're fairly inexpensive. They usually have a band that goes around your chest, and it detects your heartbeat, and then it sends a message to the watch, your watch that you're wearing. It tells you how many beats per minute you're operating at, or that you're exercising at. This is a very effective way. You can also just take your pulse periodically. But if you're running or whatever else, it's difficult to take your pulse, but you take it for 15 seconds, multiply it by 4, get the idea of how many beats per minute that would be. So those are two ways of doing it. The heart monitor is really one of the best. So let's say that you're out exercising for an hour on your bike, and you notice your heart rate, and you notice that you've exercised for 20 minutes in the zone, and the other time, you've not been in the zone, but you have been exercising. You have been working it on your bike. So you get home and you realize, well, I want to know how many calories I probably have consumed with that exercise. And if you look at any kind of chart, or even your watch may tell you, typically that's going to be about 500 calories for most individuals. Okay, so that's 500 calories. So that's pretty good when you consider that a 1 pound of fat is going to be considered 3,500 calories. You figure if you exercise one time a week, that would be, a portion of that. And so if you exercise 6 times a week at 500, then you would be at 3,000. And if you did it 7 days a week, you would be at 3,500. So if you were to exercise on your bike for 7 days, talking about what we just talked about, for about an hour, then you would probably lose one pound of fat a week. But let's look at it realistically. How many people have 7 hours to exercise in a week? Most people have other things to do. So that's one aspect. And the other aspect is that it's possible that during the day that you have utilized those 500 calories, it's possible that you might have a donut. Most donuts are probably going to push you, depending on what the donut is, could push you close to maybe 250 calories. So maybe two donuts could blow your whole hour of exercise. So when we look at weight loss, we really have to say the thing that most people don't want to hear, and that is that you also have to watch your diet as well. Because diet can just throw the whole exercise thing out the window by you just having a Big Mac, for instance. You know, I mean, that's, if you figure it out, you'd probably have to exercise another week and a half just to take care of that Big Mac. So it's like a thing that you need to calculate in your mind as far as weight loss and exercise are concerned. Still, even if we're not going for total weight loss, there is that cardiovascular benefit, which is very, very important and very, very good to have. So even if we don't even have the tremendous weight loss, at least we have a cardiovascular benefit, and that really benefits your whole body. Your body is going to be infused with oxygen. It's also going to be flowing. The blood's going to be flowing more when we exercise. This is all beneficial for your body. It clears the cobwebs. It allows for the lymphatic system to work properly. It allows for all your organ systems to work properly. It really assists you in a great way, and it also increases your level of oxygen. So you're going to have more energy. You're going to be enjoying life more the more you have exercise. So let's look at diet then. As we talked about calories, we have fat, which has more calories than anything else. Now, what's a calorie? A calorie is it's a way that we can detect what is going to be in a substance. Like, for instance, in our foods, if we were to burn our food, let's say we take some olive oil and burn it, we'd see that we get so much heat from that olive oil. And that heat coming off would be called a calorie. So that's just what we would do when we put it in our body. We're going to burn it as well for energy. So that's going to be the way that we are going to measure how much energy is inside of a food. And fat's going to have the highest energy. And remember why? Because fat's a storage of energy. It's a storage of carbohydrates, isn't it? It's a storage of sugar. So we want to store it in a form that's going to be in high energy. Now, when we look at carbohydrates and proteins, we're going to be saying that they're going to be only 4 calories per gram. So they're going to have less energy to them. But nonetheless, they're going to be an energy source. When we look at amino acids, that's going to be what a protein is composed of. If we break down a protein, we're going to get amino acids. And there's 8 to 9 essential amino acids. Let's just say that there's 8 to 9 essentials. Well, what does that mean, essential? It means that that's essential for our diet. We have to have at least 9 of these amino acids. They're called the essential amino acids. A protein deficiency can be caused by a diet that lacks 1 or more of these essential amino acids. Now, totally, there are 20 amino acids. That's how many we have totally. So that means that our body can make the other 11 if we have the essential 9. So if we have the essential 9 amino acids, then we can make all of the other 20 amino acids that we need in our body. So it is, quote, unquote, essential that we get these amino acids in our diet. So when we look at a diet, we say, well, I'd like to have a vegetarian meal for lunch. Okay, so what are you going to have? I'm going to have beans, and I'm going to have rice. I'm going to have a typical Mexican meal. You go, okay, that's great. Because beans have, if you put up your right hand and put out your fingers, it has 5 amino acids to it. But it doesn't have all the other amino acids that you need. For a complete protein, you need the essential amino acids. So all you got is your right hand, which is 5 amino acids. You need at least 4 more, right? So take your other hand and have the other 4. Turns out that the beans are your right hand, 5 amino acids, but also the rice is your left hand, which is the 4 amino acids. Put them together and you can see you've got a complete protein of 9 essential amino acids. So that's the way we have to work it. And a lot of times in different cultures that do not have a lot of meat, they've figured out how to create a complete protein by combinations. So if we eat meat, of course we have all the amino acids in there. So meat's a complete protein, but it's not the only protein source. So when we look at our diet, we see we need to have enough of the essential amino acids so that we don't come down with a protein deficiency. Now minerals are something else that you want to get in your diet. And minerals come in two forms. They're either going to be trace or macro. Remember that macro means big. So the big minerals are going to be such things as calcium, magnesium, manganese. I know you've probably heard of these. So these are going to be our macronutrients. Deficiency can cause like muscle cramps if we don't have enough calcium, for instance. And a deficiency of the trace minerals can cause problems with our thyroid. One of the trace minerals is iodine. And iodine is in very small quantities, but if you don't have it in that little small quantity, it can cause some problems with your metabolism. So macro minerals, we need lots of it. Trace minerals, we only need a little bit of it, but that doesn't imply that they're not important. It only says how much you really need in your body. Now, when we look at one of the diets, and we think of, well, what's a really good diet? Well, people think of organic foods, and they think of maybe vegetarianism, or they think of becoming a vegan, which is no meat products whatsoever, not even milk, for instance. I mean, no animal products, not even milk, not even honey. You know, a vegan would be very, very pure, if you will. And, you know, you think about these different diets. Or the Atkins diet, where you're eating nothing but meat and fat. And there's so many other diets, you know, the zone diet and the whatever diet. We have a lot of different diets. Well, one of the best diet tips that anybody can get, and some of the most, influential and popular diet programs, such as Weight Watchers and a lot of others, will propound that one of the major things you can do to assist yourself in weight loss is going to be to have water, to drink enough water. Why is that? Well, there's a whole process that the body goes through to break down fat, and it needs water to do that. So if you have enough water in your diet, that's very important. But in my estimation, I think the most important thing is the quality of the water that you drink. The quality is more important than the quantity. The quality is very, very important. Some say that you should drink water when you are thirsty. And that might be a good way of looking at it. Others say that you should have, you know, 1 ounce per every ounce of your body. You should be drinking that much water. So, I mean, there's extremes. I think personally that you should be drinking enough water to satisfy you. And if you are thirsty, you drink. And if you don't, then you shouldn't. So water makes up about 60% of our body. The thing is, though, is that some people get bad water sources, such as tap water. And you go, wait. They tell us that tap water is just fine. It is fine. Tap water is a great thing because it has been purified. It has no bacteria in it. It has a lot of positive things to it. It is safe, quote-unquote, safe to drink. But we could say that it may not be the healthiest thing to drink. So what do I mean by that? Well, by safe, it doesn't have any bacteria in it. So it's not going to cause any sort of dysentery or any intestinal problems. Like, you know, sometimes when you go to different countries, you're fearful of drinking the water because there may be things in there that may cause some problems. Well, we don't have those kind of problems with our tap water. So tap water is good. But it's a good starting point. It's not really where we should be ending. We should also consider a home filtration unit. So what we do is we get a double-stage filtration unit. You can buy them anywhere, that Sears has them or wherever else. And what you'll have is two filters. One filter will be like a charcoal filter. Another one will be like a ceramic filter or a different kind of medium filter. And what happens is the water flows through the first filter and then it flows through the second filter. By the time it gets to the second filter, it's filtered enough so that the components that made your water safe to begin with, such as chlorine, has been taken out of the water. And also, the transport of your water from the water treatment plant to your house. You know, what has happened in that transition to your house? Sometimes, you know, you pick up certain minerals, like lead, for instance, or you can pick up certain other components on its way to your house. Once it gets to your house, you want to make sure that you filter it. And that can be fairly inexpensive. Filters are not expensive at all. And it's going to be definitely less expensive than going out and buying your water, which is also a problem because there's no real regulation when you buy a bottle of water. You know, you'll think that Coca-Cola would have some kind of regulation, but they don't. There's really no regulation on our water, which is sort of weird. But that being the case, then you don't really know what you're buying. But you do if you have a filter at your home. You know that you put the filter in and you know it's filtering the water. So, and you're going to be saving money as well, and it's going to be better for you. So always, always, always drink either your own filtered water or drink some kind of water that you know is safe, you know, from a regular bottle. So when we look at organic or inorganic, we know that we have some organic foods that tend to be a little bit more expensive, and they're really coming down in price. So sometimes they're just as, you know, just the same price as others. Like, for instance, organic milk is just about the same price as your regular milk, which is a very important thing. If you drink milk, you should be drinking organic milk. Also, there's other vegetables and other fruits that we should try to, if we can, eat organic, such as strawberries. Strawberries are one fruit we should try to eat organically, because the inorganic tends to be more fertilized prone. Also, apples is another one. Apples is good to have organic. But there's some things that we don't need to be organic. There's some fruits and vegetables that are not high on the toxicity list as far as pesticides and as far as fertilizers is concerned. When we look at all living things are going to be organic, such as well, anything that's living is going to be organic. So how do you know if a fruit's organic or a vegetable's organic? All living things have hydrogen and carbon. All living things are called a hydrocarbon. Okay, that's what we are composed of. We and our bodies are composed of carbon and hydrogen put together. So what's a organic substance then? Well, a fruit or vegetable that's raised with a fertilizer that's organic. In other words, has hydrogen and carbon in it, not phosphorus only or nitrogen, like, for instance, any of the fertilizers that we would use for our plants. You know, that they're not going to have any C or H in there. It's going to be all phosphorus, potassium, or potash, and it's going to have a bit of nitrogen in there. So it's not really going to be carbon and hydrogen. But if you have manure, that's going to be carbon and hydrogen for sure. So a manure-based fertilizer is going to be organic. Also, pesticide. A pesticide that's going to be organic is going to be coming somehow from nature, whereas a non-or inorganic fertilizer is going to just be containing chemicals. So you see the difference between the two. And some individuals believe that organic is going to be better for you because it's going to be having less toxicity, you know, accompanying with it. And that may be true. So these are things to look at and think about. Now, as far as our vitamins are concerned, we already talked about minerals. There's also vitamins that we need to take in daily. And there's really going to be a number of them, and we just name them, you know, according to their letter. We have vitamin A, which is very important for epithelial tissue. And that's going to be our skin. It's going to be the inside of our blood vessels. It's going to be inside of our intestinal tract. It's going to be really all over. So epithelial tissue is very important. We also have vitamin B, which is important for cellular respiration. And cellular respiration, as you remember, is going to be the creation of ATP. We also have vitamin C, which is going to be important for our connective tissue. So anything that connects to our tissues is going to be considered connective tissue, such as bone is a connective tissue, our blood is a connective tissue, our cartilage is a connective tissue, our ligaments, our tendons. You see, all these things are connective tissues. Vitamin D is going to benefit bone, which is a connective tissue. Vitamin E is going to be an antioxidant, which is going to benefit all cells. Remember, anti means against, and oxidation is going to be where we lose the electron. So if we lose an electron from an element, that element becomes unstable. So If we're losing electrons from our skin, for instance, our skin can become unstable and we can get more wrinkles, for instance. So antioxidants are very important. And E, vitamin E, is a great antioxidant, along with vitamin C. Beta-carotene, which is really a pro-vitamin A. The body converts beta-carotene into vitamin A in the liver. So if we're taking lots of carrots, we're taking beta-carotene. And our body's going to convert that. Selenium also is a mineral, which is a great antioxidant. And you've heard of other antioxidants like green tea and red wine and the pits of grapes, grape pits, and all these different antioxidants. Folic acid is also important for our blood formation. And vitamin K is important for blood clotting. That's why I misspelled it with a K, so we can remember that it's for blood clotting. Now, if we have vitamin deficiencies, vitamin A, remember, it's going to be for the epithelium, also the epithelium of the eye. So if we have a lack of vitamin A, we'll have night blindness. Then you go, wait a minute, I can't see at night anyways. So does that mean I have night blindness? No, if it's dark, you're not seeing. That's true. What this is that it's going to be a blindness when your eyes are exposed to light. So if we are in a dark room and someone turns on the light right away and we can't see for a while, that's called night blindness. Or if we're riding in a car and another car comes by and shines the lights in our windshield like they do when they pass us, and afterwards we can't see, that would be considered night blindness. So a lack of vitamin A could cause that. A lack of vitamin B, B1 specifically, could cause beriberi, which is a Polynesian word for weak. Beriberi is a deficiency of the aerobic respiration. So we're going to be having decreased ATP, so we're going to be feeling very, very weak. They noticed beriberi when the cultures changed from having regular brown rice, which has all the nutrients that a person needs in it, as far as B vitamins, and then they changed to polished rice, where they took off the covering of the rice. And this then deprived individuals of the necessary B vitamins. So with the polished rice, beriberi was becoming more and more of an epidemic, actually. So then they realize that you need to go back to the whole grain rices. Also, B12, folic acid, and the mineral iron are responsible for, if we have a decrease, we could have an anemia. And anemia means we're going to be having a decrease. Something's going wrong with the blood. Sometimes there's a decrease of red blood cells. Sometimes there's a problem with the red blood cells. Sometimes that the red blood cells just aren't working properly. So we have a number of things that can happen if we have deficiencies of B12, folic acid, and the mineral iron. And those would be collectively called anemia. Now, vitamin C deficiency can cause a condition which is called scurvy. Scurvy is going to be a condition of the soft tissue. Why is that? Because vitamin C is important for soft tissue. So what would be the symptoms of scurvy? Well, primary one would be the teeth fall out. The teeth fall out because the connective tissue supporting the teeth is not there any longer, so it's going to be, or weakening, and that soft tissue then will allow the teeth to fall out. That's not the worst thing that happens, though, is that there's also connective tissue in our blood vessels. So the inside is epithelium, but the outside is going to be connective tissue. So as the individual has a lack of vitamin C, their vessels will start to burst, and they will actually have hemorrhage. And that's ultimately how a person dies, would be from hemorrhage, from blood loss. And vitamin C deficiency was really noticed in individuals who were explorers. Also in individuals that were in the shipping industry. So any kind of sailor could come down with scurvy because they wouldn't get their vitamin C. They normally would on land, like from their green leafy vegetables or from fruits. And since you're on a ship, you don't have that available, so scurvy was a real problem for sailors until the British discovered that if they made their sailors have a lime periodically, and limes keep very well in the ships, if they gave them limes once in a while, that they didn't get scurvy. They didn't know why, but they knew it was definitely a fact. So they made their sailors have a lime periodically, and that prevented scurvy, and that's one of the reasons why the Great Britain was a power on the ocean for quite a while. Remember, there used to be a quote that the sun never sets on the British Empire, because the sailors would just be able to go all through the globe, and they had no scurvy. And one of the reasons that they had a derogatory term for them was because they ate so many limes, and of course a derogatory term for a British sailor is a limey. Now, vitamin D is going to be, if it's deficient, you can get a condition called rickets. And rickets will cause the bones to be soft. So we see a baby who has bow legs. The reason is because the legs are soft, the baby's body is heavy, and it causes the legs to bow. It looks like they've been riding a horse. So that's going to be the vitamin D deficiency causing rickets. Vitamin K, as we already talked about, is going to be important for blood clotting. If we don't have enough of it, we can have blood loss. And the toxic vitamins that's classically mentioned are A, D, E, and K. Now, why are these called toxic? Well, because they're fat-soluble. In other words, they're going to dissolve in fat. The other B vitamins, for instance, are going to be water-soluble. They dissolve in water. So essentially, you can pee them out if you get too much. But if you have too much of these toxic vitamins, it's possible for them to build up in your system because they're going to be building up in your fat. Truth be known, these are really never, hardly ever toxic. The only known toxicity to vitamin A has been when individuals have eaten polar bear liver. Eat a polar bear liver, it has lots of vitamin A in it, it's too much and you could die from that. But polar bear liver is not readily available. Also, vitamin D, we've noticed of late that we're getting less and less vitamin D. And it's been recommended that we actually take the vitamin D supplements. Vitamin E is probably one of the ones that we should probably not take too much of. Maybe 200 international units is probably about all we really do need of vitamin E. And vitamin K also, we don't need to take a lot of that as well. But as far as real toxicity, we see this in individuals who are into mega dosing of vitamins. And so they'll be taking multiple vitamins. And this can be a problem. So when we look at diet and prevention of disease, we realize that we need to supplement. As I just said, vitamin D is very important, and we have to get that through a supplement. There's also a variety of other nutrients that we need to have supplementation for. Remember, it's a supplement. Your diet should be good, and we should then supplement your diet with nutrients that you may not be getting in proper quantities. So we don't want to have it being a substitution for the diet. We're going to be taking vitamin pills and vitamin concoctions and whatever so that we can have a supplement to our diet. One of the things that I always recommend is that an individual should take a multiple vitamin. It's better to get a multiple vitamin from a health food store or to go online and go to Standard Process. Standard Process has a number of vitamins, their whole food supplements, and one of their multiple vitamins is called Catalin. So I recommend 3 Catalin a day, and they're, like I say, whole foods. So that would be a source, or like I say, go to a health food store. Solgar makes a very good multiple vitamin. They have the VM75, which has 75 of most of our nutrients that we need. So a good multiple vitamin is a good place to start as far as supplementing our diet. Now, atherosclerosis is going to be a closing of the arteries. This can be caused from a problem with our diet, such as too much homocysteine. Homocysteine is going to be too high in the blood, and that can actually tear the blood vessels. If the blood vessels tear, the body will try to heal that with fat deposits or cholesterol deposits. So when you look at the cholesterol or fat building up in a wall of the artery, you don't think it's necessarily from cholesterol, but rather it could be from homocysteine. Homocysteine is taken care of by having proper B vitamins and folic acid. So if you have a multiple vitamin, you're going to be less likely to have high homocysteine. So there's good cholesterol and there's bad cholesterol. The good cholesterol is what we want to raise in our blood. The bad cholesterol is what we want lowered in our blood. Good cholesterol is the happy DL or the high density lipoproteins. The bad cholesterol is the very low and the low down lipids. The very low is going to be very low density lipoproteins and low density lipoproteins. So just remember that the good cholesterol is the happy one, the one with the HDL. We know that hydrogenated fats aren't good for us. We've heard this probably before. What's a hydrogenated fat? Well, remember that we have our carbons, and carbons are going to be, if we have a long carbon chain, it's going to be a fat. Now, we can have our carbons, and we can have all of the carbons having hydrogens around them. If we have this situation, that's called a saturated fat. Saturated fats are going to be carbons with all the hydrogens filled in. Saturated fat. Now, we can have some double bonds between these carbons. They're going to be having less hydrogens. Therefore, we're going to call this a unsaturated fat. And depending on where those double bonds are, we're going to call it either an omega-3, omega-6, omega-9. It all depends where that double bond is. So that's where we get our unsaturated fats, which are very good for us. Saturated fats are also good for us in small quantities. Butter is a saturated fat. It's okay for us. We have some saturated fats in fish. We have some unsaturated fats in meats. So we don't want to be afraid of saturated fats. And unsaturated fats, of course, are very natural as well. They're going to be coming from mostly plants. The saturated fats come from mostly animal products. So one of the things we want to avoid, though, is the trans fat. When we look at a regular saturated fat, and we see that it has all the hydrogen bonds, and it has those hydrogens there, and maybe one double bond, but it's still considered a saturated fat. You'll see that the cyst form, which is the natural form, which you would get from butter, okay, would be a cyst form, or it's going to look like a V. It's going to be a little bent. The trans form is going to be where it's going to be totally straight. Now, what's the significance of this? Well, the cyst form is going to incorporate in our cells and allow for transport of nutrients in the cell and allow for waste products to go out of the cell. The trans form, because it's straight, will not allow for transport in or for waste to get out. So the cell is going to be under compromise if there's lots of trans fats. And the cell, as you know, is the start of life. So you start messing up with the start of life, you can have all sorts of disease situations, even going up to cancer. But headaches can be a problem, fatigue, tiredness, all sorts of things can be the result of lots of trans fats. So you go, well, where do we get these trans fats from? Well, they're man-made. We take a good fat, which is an unsaturated fat, and because that could become rancid too fast, we want to make it more stable. We irradiate it with hydrogens. So now we have a good fat, originally a good fat, an unsaturated fat, and we turn it to a life of crime, making it into a trans fat. That's why we call trans fats hydrogenated, because we took a good fat and turned it to a life of crime, making it hydrogenated. So it's a straight fat, and it's bad for us, because it's going to impede, really, the cell function. How do you know if you're eating hydrogenated fats? Well, one way is it comes from a package. If it's man-made, it's going to be coming from a package. So you have to read your packages, such as potato chips or anything that's packaged. You want to make sure that you read that to see whether or not there is any trans fats in that food and avoid those. Because friends don't let friends eat partially hydrogenated fats, which are trans fats. Now, we can use diet to prevent some diseases. We know that high fat and meat consumption relate to increased cancer. Low fat and increased vegetables and fruits will lower blood pressure and also decrease cancer. So we have a number of studies that have been done as far as we increase meat consumption, we increase our cancer as well. So we have to realize that the body is, as we already said, we tend to be more towards vegetables and fruits anatomically. And so that's really what our diet should be more of. So that's it for our talk on nutrition. I hope you enjoyed that. And I'll see you again on another biology on the beach. Bye now.